Okay, well, I'm here, man. At this time, it is my great pleasure to introduce to you our speaker from Los Angeles, Alan B.
Good evening. My name is Alan Bernstein. I'm an alcoholic. And I am delighted to be here with you all tonight. I want to thank Lee and the committee for inviting me up. I want to welcome Central Coast back. It's exciting. To take sort of an unplanned hiatus and then to get the cogs of the machinery going again. I'm delighted to be here with my friend Georgia. You'll be hearing from her tomorrow night. It takes all the pressure off of me. She gives a great talk. She can clean up any mediocrity that I deliver. I'm going to show that sobriety and steps will remove my fear, because if you have any experience speaking, you know, always pay attention to who's going to have the microphone last, because that means they get the last word. But I'm still going to take a ding at her and risk it tomorrow. I was talking before the meeting about just... And it's a little unfamiliar to speak for a long time. I said, I know, I'll get through it. I go, but I don't know that I have an hour's worth of material. And she goes, I know what you mean. I don't know if you do either. That's love. I'm from LA. My home group is the Pacific Group. We don't meet in Brentwood. We now meet in Culver City. For many years, we've been in Brentwood, and for many years, my sponsor is Clancy I, who founded the group, and who passed away about a year ago in August. And my sponsor now is Matt J. in Santa Barbara, not far from here. Many of you may know him. And my sobriety date is April 16th of 1990. I'm sponsored. I sponsor people. I have a good life. I'll tell you some stories about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. But honestly, this is what I can tell you. I can tell you that I have a good life, and I can tell you that one thing that I learned in the last 18 months is that AA works. Our circumstances change. We get thrown curveballs. That's life. But AA works, and the challenge for me has often been just not to graduate from Alcoholics Anonymous, not to convince myself I'm so clever that I can somehow or other move on to the next stage. There is no next stage. If you're new, and I imagine some of you are new here tonight, almost everything I needed to know in order to live sane one day at a time, I learned in the first 90 days. And then I spent 31 years repeating it, and what a blessing. You know, it's funny. I am instinctively of the nature that anything you have to do over and over again is a chore or a punishment. I mean, that's just my orientation and my wiring, but that's not what AA has been for me. AA has been an opportunity to sort of put a very simple spiritual practice into effect and maintain it, and to reap rewards far greater than anything I've put in. I was born, as many of these stories start, I was born in Brooklyn, New York. It is the coolest thing I've done. That is as much street cred as I ever got, being born in Brooklyn. Dad was in the Army doing intelligence work. Mom had been a school teacher in the public school system. I was a wanted child. I was welcomed. I had two younger brothers. My middle brother was adopted, and back then fertility was not understood. Mom couldn't seem to have a baby, so they adopted a baby, and 7 months later, during the lunar landing, she couldn't stay awake. That was 1969. She couldn't stay awake, and my father was really irritated because they were landing on the moon, and how could she not stay awake? And it turned out she was pregnant. And so I had two younger brothers, and we struggled. Dad had financial reverses. We didn't grow up with money. We moved to the Midwest when I was 10 years old. I grew up eating chicken. It doesn't sound like torture now, but no one ate chicken in the 1970s in the Midwest. You ate like meat, and we couldn't really afford meat. And Mom was on a budget, and times were tough, but they stayed together, and they did their best to raise their kids with values. If alcoholism was the byproduct of an abusive childhood, you would have a different speaker, because that's not my story. By the way, that is other people's stories, and my observation in 31 years is that the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous offer us an avenue for recovery from all kinds of things. But, you know, I'm just a kid raised by loving parents who tried to give me values and a good education, and I was miserable. I landed in the Midwest. I'm 10. I have a big, bushy red jufro. I have an East Coast accent. I have a speech impediment. I wear husky jeans. If you're younger, you might not, it means I'm like a chunkster. And everyone else is like tall and thin. They have brown hair or blonde hair. They have blue eyes. They're all athletic. All of them. You know, they all have the same name. They all, like, you know, they're all either Catholic or Lutheran. I'm Jewish. There are like 5 Jews in the entire city. And I'm just uncomfortable in my own skin. I'm nerdy. I'm already young, and they want to move me ahead a year. My mother, thank God, realized I would have been like, you know, cannon fodder, and just, you know, held me back or didn't just get me in place. I just needed to escape because I'm uncomfortable in my own skin. When I was 10 or 11, I discovered that drinking worked. And this is how I discovered it. We went to temple. There was like one temple for the entire western suburbs of Chicago. And we would go to services on Friday nights. That's when Jews go. And at the end of services, you end the services, and then you break bread. It's called challah, and you break the bread, and then you bless the wine. And this is like the 1970s, so nobody got grape juice. And the moms overpoured, like, you know, I'm just like moms everywhere from time immemorial. They just didn't want to not have enough. So if there were 75 people at services, they poured like 150 of these shots of Manischewitz wine. I'm not here to recommend Manischewitz if you're sober. I would encourage you to go to bed sober tonight and start tomorrow. But to tell you about Manischewitz, if you never had it, is a wine formulated for the sophisticated palate of an 11-year-old. It's incredibly sweet. And we would like each do our one shot, and then the parents and the younger kids would move down to the social hall for cookies and punch. And my friends and I would stay back and do shot contests of Manischewitz wine, and it worked. You know, it relieved the discomfort, and I learned a really important lesson for me early on. I learned, because after it was over, we did have to make our way down to the social hall for the regular reception, and you can't drink 10 or 20 shots of Manischewitz and not smell like, you know, grape perfume. So what I learned is basically, if you don't insult the rabbi and if you don't throw up on his wife, nobody cares. Like, that's, you know, that's the trick. The trick is people actually don't think a lot about me. If I don't offend you sufficiently, you're going to leave me alone. And that's really important, because what I discovered when I started drinking is that it worked. That the discomfort got relieved, and it was effective medication, and it's what I needed. And I want to also tell you, I arrived in AA a big believer in secrets. If you're new to AA or been here a little while, we tell you your sick is your secret. You know, we ask you about an inventory and disclose things. That is part of, for me, the process of recovery and healing. But my dad was a military intelligence officer. I grew up in a family believing that secrets were power, that when you knew something, what you do is you keep it to yourself and you wait for an opportunity to use it for advantage. I'm firmly of the idea that secrets are good, secrets are power, secrets are knowledge. And so I'm not going to tell you that drinking works. I'm just going to file away. When I drink, I stop feeling awful, and I need to find ways to get that feeling and maintain it. And that's what I file away. So I go off to high school. I have a bit of a thespian career, a bit of an acting career in high school and college. So I go to a very big public high school. It's like 3,500 kids, open campus, you know, like burnouts and raws and like all that kind of stuff. And it's in Elmhurst, Illinois. Let me tell you about Elmhurst. Nothing ever happens in Elmhurst, ever. But one Saturday night, this is a story about Apple TV. It used to be like, so if you're new and you're used to like streaming and like DVDs, like this is going to sound really weird, but talk to your sponsor afterwards and they'll confirm that I'm telling you the truth. There used to only be like 4 or 5 channels on TV, and they just aired stuff. It just went by. You either caught it or you didn't. You know, for those of us who got server before all the feedback, like their entire shows we never got to see because there was, you know, like, if your home group was on Wednesday night, you didn't see, you know, if your home group was on Thursday night, you never saw Friends. Like, sorry, that's just how it worked. And until repeats and later. But there was a show called Fantasy Island back in the late 70s on ABC. And one Saturday night, the plane landed. And Ricardo Montalban and the little guy walked up to and watched this pretty sad-looking woman get off the plane, and the little guy said to Ricardo Montalban that this woman had come to Fantasy Island to escape her past as a streetwalker in Elmhurst, Illinois. And that Monday, the high school was a buzz with people trying to figure out what street anyone could have walked in my hometown. Elmhurst, Illinois was so square that there was a bar in Elmhurst called The Closet, and it was not a gay bar. It was just a tiny narrow bar, and like that's Elmhurst. And I try out freshman year for, we do one big musical, and we did The Sound of Music, and I tried out for The Sound of Music as a freshman, and I didn't get cast. I did have a bit of an acting career after that, and the director later explained to me that when I tried out as a freshman for The Sound of Music, I was not good enough for any of the roles, and the only option that he had, and as he put it, was he was remarkably uncomfortable with the idea of casting his one Jewish kid in the role of a Nazi. So I sat out The Sound of Music. But at the end of the run of the show, a couple of the girls kept their nun's habits. And what we learned very quickly is if you take a 15 or 16-year-old girl and put her in a nun's habit and smear a little bit of blush and lipstick on her and shove her into a package store, no one is going to card little sister Tiffany Brittany. And that's how we started storing alcohol. And I loved it. I'm old enough that when I was starting to drink, there were other, Wisconsin like had a younger drinking age, but Illinois was already a 21 drinking age, and we weren't near Wisconsin. That was not practical, so we had to score things underage. It was all about portability. We immediately went to like Everclear and 151, really, really high proof things that were easy to hide in the car and transport. It's the early 80s. It's before MTV. It's before the concept of cool parents who will let you party in the basement if you turn in your car keys. Like, none of that exists yet. So we just drive around the streets of, the western suburbs and drink. I have a 66 Dodge Dart that my grandmother, Grandma Sarah, had given me. Grandma Sarah was like 4'11" and about as wide around. And she just, she drove as long as she could, and then she gave me her car. This car had no air conditioning and no heating in the Midwest in the winter. That's a big deal. It had no radio. And part of the floor underneath the passenger side had rusted out because we salt our streets there in the winter. And it was by far the best car that anyone had. So I'm driving, and occasionally we're literally like dropping things out, the bottom of the car. We're idiots, but I love the effects produced by alcohol. I also, you know, I spoke here a few years ago. In fairness, Lee came down to speak for me in Brentwood one time, so it was only fair that I come back here when he invited me. And I brought my son, who's now 17, he's probably 13 at the time. I remember he, like, was in that room with a little kid, like, during the meeting when I gave my talk. And, you know, he's driving now. I have twin girls. They're 15 and a half. One of them got her permit last week. The other, thank God, she's just taking forever to work through her permitting class. I just hope she never gets her permit. She's going to be terrible. I know, sorry, honey, I love you if you're listening to this later, but you're going to be a terrible driver. That's just, yeah. I mean, you joke about it, and you're right. And, but, you know, in AA, it's amusing what I did, you know, just like drinking Everclear and driving around in an old 66 Dodge Dart. But the truth is, we were a danger to other people's children, to other people, and it's not funny. And I'm actually just really overpaid that I have not had to clean up the wreckage of destroying other people's lives because of my idiotic driving. I did something at the end of high school that was very smart. As is often the case, I did it without any intentions, but I went to a school where it was not necessary to drive. I went to college. It was now, you know, the 80s, and there was this satire book called The Preppy Handbook that was a big deal, and I was too drunk and too weird to realize that it was a comedy book. I thought it was actually an instruction manual for life, and I picked the top 10 preppy drinking school for college out of that book and went off. I just happened to pick a good school, and it's gotten better over the years, so my story is filled with undeserved benefits. One thing, by the way, let me tell you something if you're new. Grab every undeserved benefit you get. Life will also punish us in ways that we don't entirely deserve, so just take the things that are, you know, given to you, and let's go on to being good. But I headed off there, and I fell madly in love with beer. It's the 80s. I discover beer. I immediately have a beer of choice. It's Budweiser, which is, of course, the king of beers. And I love Bud Longnecks. I'm in the school in North Carolina, and it's very hot and humid down there, especially at the start of the school year. And I just love, and I can still remember, like, the feeling of a bottle of Bud Longneck, like the heft of the bottle and how it would sweat a little bit. I remember how, like, you could take the label off, and then I'd always try to reattach the label, and it would never stick. And but the concentration, if the room was starting to spin, the focus was good. So I loved that. But really, what I immediately gravitated towards was pitchers and kegs. I pledged to fraternity. I'm a Southern frat boy, which is endlessly amusing, because if you ever play that game, you have to tell two truths about yourself and one lie. I almost always like to make one of my truths I'm a Southern frat boy, because usually people are like, you're like a New Yorker, right? And but I was a Southern frat boy, and we would have kegs and like sing along at the end of the night to have the Eagles doing Desperado. And I developed a secondary, not addiction, but like compulsion. In addition to just sort of loving being drunk as much as I possibly could, I found that I loved adrenaline. There was nothing quite like coming to on a Thursday morning after the Wednesday keg and realizing, oh crap, I have a paper due at 3 o'clock. And all of a sudden, just a surge of adrenaline and distraction. I just need to be distracted for myself really, really badly, because I'm a victim of a lovely suburban childhood in a leafy suburb with parents who stayed married for a long time and struggled their best to provide, and it's just not enough. And by the way, for what it's worth, that is the truth. The truth is, I know that there's nothing wrong with my life, and my constant shame is that I'm so miserable and uncomfortable, and there's no good reason. I don't even have anything to hang it on. Like, you know, I feel like we live in a victim culture where if you can claim a victimhood, you can ride it. I'm not a victim. I have a good life. I'm just a miserable person who, no matter what you give me, is never enough. And so I drink. And I get to my senior year. I get cast in Well, two things happen. I get invited by the state of Illinois to go home to interview for a scholarship. But if I get it, I get to go study in England for 2 years. But I don't get it, which is, you know, whatever. But while I'm there in Illinois, I miss all the job signups for job interviews. And I take the boards to apply for graduate school, but I don't ever bother to apply because I'm sort of too busy being in a show and drinking a lot. And just a little hint, if you ever want to continue your education, turns out you need to hand in the application. There's a very, very low percentage of people who get accepted without applying, and no acceptances arrive in my mailbox. And now it's March of my senior year. I'm facing the very real prospect of going back to Illinois to live in my parents' house. And my last job was like about the worst job that an alcoholic of my type can have. I spent the summer working at Marshall Fields, which was a department store back then, in sheets and towels. And that's agony because nobody shops for sheets and towels without asking the people who are working there for their opinions and help. And look, I know that we have Al-Anon people here. I look forward to hearing the Al-Anon speaker. I am not by inclination an Al-Anon. I do not think a lot about other people. I've learned in 31 years of daily practice how to have a more genuine interest in my fellow man. But it is just, you come into Marshall Fields, into the sheets and towels department, where some sadist must have thought, we're going to put him in sheets and towels. And people want to know about, like, colors. Like, what color do I recommend? And none of the colors are, like, green or brown. It's always, like, forest or taupe or champagne. Like, you have to learn all these colors. And you have to talk to people, and you have to act like you care about their bathroom and I'm going to have to go home and live with Mommy and Daddy and do more of this. And I am walking one day past where all the job sign-ups are. Nothing's online because that doesn't exist yet. I mean, we're basically about 5 minutes past, like, punch cards for computers, and I don't think we have answering machines yet, and there's an opening for a job in New York, and I go and ask if I can have that interview, and it's my one shot, and I don't know about any of you, but I actually do surprisingly well in moments of panic, like, when I'm drinking, like, when my entire life has come down to, you have to get through this, because there's no other option, I'm, like, focused and present, and I go and I find more charm than I've ever had, and I banter and act interested in banking. There's not a course on my entire, like, resume of whatever they're called, transcripts, but, like, and they invite me for a second interview, and they fly me to New York, and they take me out for lunch, and we get sushi, which I've never even heard of before. It's the 80s. Like, this is, you know, and I immediately think, they'd be lucky to have me. But they give me the job, and I pack up everything, and I have my little Brooks Brothers suits, and I head off to this banking job in New York, and I get a studio apartment on the East Side. You know, within a week, I find my real job. My real job is pub crawling through the dive bars of Manhattan. And I had a feeling you were my people. There's nothing like a dive bar. Look, I am such a snob when I get to AA that literally, I think, like, the only things worth drinking are clear or brown. Maybe in the morning, a Bloody Mary or a screwdriver, because honestly, you need some way to get orange juice down. But when people talk about having, like, fancy colored drinks, I think, oh wow, it got really bad if you had to go there. And I love dive bars, and New York is filled with dive bars. So I show up to work, and at 5 o'clock we are done, and I am a quick change artist. I'm out of my little suit. I'm into, like, old jeans and ratty old Oxford shirts. And we go downtown, and it's like a Disneyland for a 21-year-old drunk. And we go to the Lithuanian bars and the Ukrainian bars, and If anyone remembers Crocodile Dundee, part of that was filmed at this bar called Bay's Action, 7th and B. And at 2nd and A, there's a gas station that's been converted into a bar. Like magic, what a cool thing that is. And it's just big adventure. And when I said it, it's my job, here's what I'm telling you. I don't even show up to work on time. By the way, it is amazing, like, and my timing is good. There was a boom on Wall Street in the late 80s, and they needed bodies, and I was willing to be a body. I don't even show up on time, and I don't even make up, like, I don't even make up lies. I'm just like, oh, sorry, I'm late, I was hungover. And for some reason, they're like, well, you're not going to be much of a competition for promotions or bonuses, so, you know, your desk can do whatever you can, kid. And I spend 6, 8, 10 hours, like, going to dive bars. That's truly my job. And I got sober in 90, and when I got sober, the cocaine addicts always, for some reason, loves to quantify the amount they spend. It's like this pissing match that they all have, like, how much did you spend? And one day I sat down and figured out I did a little bit of recreational crack, but mostly I drank. And I figured out how much I spent on booze, and I'm like, you cocaine people are not as impressive as you think. You can spend a lot of money on booze in Manhattan. And here's what I want to say. In our book, which I've not mentioned yet, so I'll just put in a plug right now, for the AA-approved literature, particularly the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it describes the progressive nature of our disease. It describes how alcoholism is cunning and baffling and powerful. And to me, what that means is alcoholism is, at its core, an almost imperceptible disease. We're in it, but, you know, sort of like that story about how you can put a frog in cool water, and if you heat the water slowly enough, it won't even notice that the water is boiling it. You know, to me, that's alcoholism. I'm in it, and I don't even notice how it's sort of destroying my life. And one of the most clear-cut ways to me is that drinking and pub crawling was a massive, huge, fun adventure for the first year or two, and then very slowly and imperceptibly, it just became too much. Things that I used to have the energy for began to exhaust me. And where I used to love to go here and there and, you know, what danger, what excitement will come next, I start to get weary. I don't like to go to new places. I don't know where to stand. I don't know how to get the bartender's attention. And my world gets smaller and smaller, but it happens without me even noticing it. But one day I realized I've moved into one dive bar, and I spent the last 2 years of my drinking at this bar called the Village Idiot. It's not there anymore, but when my kids were in preschool, there was a bar on Melrose called the Village Idiot that I had to drive past twice a day while, like, driving in my kitchen minivan with, like, 3 kids to preschool. And the Village Idiot that I went to was long and dark and narrow. It had junkies shooting up in the bathroom. It had parolees violating with concealed weapons. It was like everything I dreamed of. It was great. There was a jukebox with a lot of sad music. I recommend sad music when drinking. There was a lot of Patsy Cline. I don't know why they had country western in New York, but a lot of Patsy Cline. There was that song by Freda Payne called Band of Gold about the husband who ditches his husband, his wife on their wedding night, and my all-time favorite song, Brandy, You're a Fine Girl, What a Good Wife You'd Be. And I just went there every night. I make up stories. So first of all, I hustle drinks because that job that was really so easy and paid me so well, I had some strange, dumb moment of purity. Like I hate being a banker, and I quit. And they're like, okay, well, if you want to quit, we'll accept it. If you're an active alcoholic with a job that's paying you too much for doing very little work, may I recommend don't have some moment of, like, intellectual purity. That's not, you know, smart. So now I'm scrambling for money. I'm doing odd jobs. I'm hustling drinks. I hustle drinks in 2 ways. I tell you heartbreaking stories about things that have happened to me, horrible things that have happened to me. And for some reason, although I'm completely making them up, I feel them. So, you know, like when I tell you the story, I sell it. And what I discover is that when I tell these terrible stories, if I tell them well enough, you will probably buy me a drink or two, and you may want me to have a positive sexual experience. And I'm fine with that. And the other thing that I do to get drinks is way more painful and mortifying than that. And instead, if you've never been to a dive bar, there's always somebody in a dive bar who really needs to be heard. They got to talk, and they need somebody to listen to them. And I will listen to you talk. And again, I can't wait to hear the Al-Anon talk tomorrow. I have high regard for Al-Anon, but I just cannot tell you what work it is for me to listen to somebody else talk about their life in a bar. But I need a drink. And once I start drinking, I do what I have to do. So I will listen to you. So I spent 2 years drunk in the Village Idiot listening to people tell me exactly what's going on in their life, and I never have a moment of identification. If you're new, that's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous, is that somehow or other we identify. We all have different stories, many very different stories, but there's this emotional resonance to our stories, and there's this thing that happens where, you know, we identify, and it's wild. Just like a good point to drop in and point this out, like I'm gay, so let me just get that out of the way. I don't think anyone cares anymore, but I do want to tell you that because occasionally I think people feel like if they identify with my talk, it may mean something about like them being gay. Like, I just want to assure you, if you're identifying with my talk, it doesn't mean you're gay, unless you are. And it's just alcoholism. It's wild how we come from different places and different experiences, but we speak this language of the heart. But I don't speak it in a bar. I don't speak it drunk in a bar. And what I believe is I spent 2 years as a barfly in a bar, and I believe that entire time that I am actually enrolled in some sort of secret cultural anthropology master's program. I convinced myself that I am studying the barflies of the Village Idiot. I like to say I'm like the Margaret Mead of downtown Manhattan, and that somehow or other I have infiltrated these people and convinced them that I'm one of them. I'm a barfly, people. I'm drunk every night and hustling drinks like everybody, but I convinced myself that I'm special, and I think that is the hallmark of alcoholism. My suicidal belief that I am special, that my case is different, and that therefore I am sort of beyond hope, beyond correction. And so that's just happening. My life is getting smaller and smaller. I have this family. They're good. I've got a good family. I've got loving parents. I've got loving grandparents. I've got cousins who care about me. But let me tell you, about the late 80s, especially if you're younger, we didn't have social media. You could actually ditch people back then. It's really hard to get away from anybody nowadays. And if you do, it's like, what do you mean? Why are you off Snapchat? But back then, you know, like, you could just sort of ghost people, is that what they call it now. And that's what I do, because here's the truth. I do have the apartment. I never lose the apartment, but I'm basically living on the street, by which I mean regularly at 2 and 3 in the morning. I'm walking around Alphabet City back when they were still having riots in Alphabet City, and I'm drunk out of my mind, and I have this idea that I'm invulnerable, and I do feel sort of this innate ability to be prepared for like a direct frontal violent attack. What I am completely defenseless against as an alcoholic is a loving person looking at me with concern, you know. And I've been a kid who had done well. I went to a good school. This is a drinking school, but it's a good school. And I came from a family that had pride in me, that was excited to see. They were, as families will do, they were invested in me. They were excited to see where I was going. And I got this job on Wall Street, and they sort of trusted me to do something, but they were waiting for me to do something. And I'm not down the drain, but I'm circling the drain. I'm in an elaborate and slow rotation. I'm circling the drain. And they're confused, and they're worried. And it's all loving and kind, but that feels like a hot knife being, like, pressed into me, you know, that kind of thing. And I don't know how to tell them what's going on. I believe in secrets. I'm not going to reveal that I'm lost and that I need to medicate myself, and I don't know why. So I do the only logical thing, and I cut them off. If you're new, we're going to ask you to write an inventory. And in that inventory, we're going to ask you to talk about things that you resented and things that you were afraid of. And we're going to ask you to sort of look at who you hurt. And I was the kind of person who wasn't clear when I wrote my first inventory that I'd hurt anybody. But, you know, I'm a father of three. And if my children abandoned me because they couldn't, you know, handle my affection for them, it would break my heart. That's who I am. I'm somebody who punishes you for caring about me by withdrawing. And I'm really lonely. And I don't know it because I'm still doing a pretty good job of drinking enough to medicate how lonely and afraid I am. And what happens is in February of 1990, I go out drinking one night. And in our big book, one of our founders, Bill Wilson, in his story called Bill's Story, talks about having a white light experience. He talks about being in a sanitarium, jittery, barely sober, with people visiting, trying to help him. And his white light experience is literally a perception of bright light and a sense for Bill of the nearness of his creator. And it's a beautiful story, and I'm not really doing a good enough job of expressing it, so if you haven't read it, I would encourage you to read it. But he describes that this moment as transformative, and it sort of puts him onto this path to getting sober, which, by the way, if you're new, it's kind of important because basically it's a ripple that comes to all of us because that's where the program starts and that's what we all benefit from. I literally, in February of 1990, had the opposite. I had a dark light moment. I'm in a dark bar. That's not unusual. I'm drunk. That's not unusual. But somehow or other, there's this moment where it gets perceptibly darker to me and suddenly I'm drunk, but I'm not as blurry as I need to be. I'm suddenly much more clear-headed than I ever want to be. And I get how separated I am. I see the distance between me and Lee, but even, you know, I see that you're holding hands, but in my mind, I see atoms and molecules between your hands. I suspect that you believe you're connecting, but I see that we're all separated from each other. And I don't know if I'm explaining it well, but here's what I can tell you. I've been alone for a long time. I've pushed people who love me away. I've gladly traded away whatever kind of dignity and self-respect I might have had it for some booze and just for some distraction from the pain. I've told horrible, horrible lies. I've marketed on things that it's just disgraceful to talk about things for advantage that are true traumas for other people. I'm just not a good person. And I don't understand it because I know that I was raised to be a good person. I know that I meant to be a good person, but I need to drink. And when I drink, I need to feed it, and I'm alone. And in this dark light moment, what I've avoided pretty successfully through 10 years of being drunk suddenly becomes very clear. I'm completely alone. I'm completely abandoned, and I will always be that way. And the weird, weird thing is the drinking stops working. I drank because it worked. I drank because it medicated the discomfort. I didn't expect to not have hangovers. I didn't expect to not humiliate myself. I didn't expect to not let you down. I'm a Midwesterner. I mean, I was born in New York, but I grew up in the Midwest. I understand the idea of a deal. And the deal was alcohol would cause me pain and embarrassment, but it would make me comfortable enough to at least get through to tomorrow. And I was willing to accept that deal. And now it didn't work. And I was like somebody who was abandoned by a lover that I never thought would abandon me. And I was lost and confused and hurt. I tried a brief experiment in control drinking. I tried having two drinks a night. It's awful. Oh, my God. I have these two daughters, and I just got to tell you, like, I hope they find love. I hope they get married. I'm not going to get married to this, but I don't care that I can't have a champagne toast. To me, the only value of champagne is if there's like a champagne fountain and you sort of dive into it and swim around and drink a lot, that might be appealing. But like a little, like, amateur drinking doesn't work for me at all. It doesn't make me jealous. I don't even quite get it. But drinking like a pig, I get. And I tried the two drinks tonight and that doesn't work. And at the end of like 2 weeks, I overshoot the mark, which was a relief. But my head doesn't turn off, which is what I need. I need to turn this loud, angry, relentless head off. So my next idea, it's now late February of 1990. Mardi Gras is coming up, and I decide to get sober for Lent. Now, I'm Jewish, as I've mentioned, and we're not known for our Lenten practice, but it's the best I can do, and so I white knuckle through 40 days and 40 very long nights of Lent, and I go out of my mind. I'm manic, I'm crazed, I'm bouncing off walls, and I'm still going out, I'm in bars, but you know, it's like funny, like this Jewish kid is like staying sober for Lent, and everyone finds it vaguely amusing. And here's what I can tell you about dive bars: no one really wants to know about your real pain. Like they're perfectly willing to like accept like the joke and just move on, but I'm going crazy, and I'm also very manic. I have a lot of energy because I just do, and on Easter Sunday I wind up at the Sound Factory. The Sound Factory in 1990 was literally the coolest nightclub in the known world. I mean, it was like, it was it. And you had to go through a metal detector to get there, and oh, like there's like Madonna, and there's David Bowie, and it's like hip and happening, and I'm dancing, because I'm manic, and I'm just bouncing off things. And at 2:30 in the morning, I meet somebody who's 2.5 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. In our 12 and 12, in the third step, which is, in the second step, I'm asked to come to believe in something bigger than myself. And in the third step, I'm asked to make a decision to surrender my life to something bigger than myself. That's what we're asked to do here, as I understand it. And in the third step, in the 12 and 12, it describes the door to faith, describes the approach to faith as a door. And it describes it as being like a locked door with no visible keyhole. And it says, but if we have the slightest bit of willingness to have faith, it's just that that keyhole magically appears and the door opens. And I don't know why I work this way, but at 2:30 in the morning on Easter Sunday in 1990, I met somebody who was 2.5 years sober. And I think my final resistance was, I thought, as miserable as my life is, I do not think that I have presented my life to you as the life that you're like, I wish I could have been him back then. But I just thought, I'm not ready. Like, I'm not ready for church basements. I'm not ready for, like, you know, AA coffee. I'm just not ready for it. And there was this guy, Anthony, who seemed cool, and he was in the right place, and he was 2.5 years sober. And that was like maybe this glimmer of hope. By the way, I didn't know anything about AA. I'm prior to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a big believer in the value of contempt prior to investigation. It struck me that it saves you a lot of time. You know, just figure out why something doesn't work and you don't have to deal with it. If you actually like have to go do it, it's a lot more time consuming. So I had rejected AA with no experience, and I had no problem with that. But he made me question my contempt. And that keyhole appeared and the door opened. And on Easter Sunday, I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was called High Noon. I have to give myself some credit. Like, talk about, like, I surrendered at High Noon. I ran into this gal, Alicia, who I'd known from out and about. I didn't know she was sober. I'd always thought she was kind of cool. And she saw me there. She swept me up. She took me for, a meal at some Greek diner after the meeting. And she talked to me about her alcoholism, like I'm trying to talk to you about my alcoholism. I'm not here to tell you what your alcoholism is or it's not. The magic of AA is that we identify, and somewhere in the midst of her talking about her experience, I had a moment of identification. I thought about that moment a lot over the years because I don't believe that identification is enough to keep me physically sober. I think, with 31 years of experience, one day at a time, that my experience has been that you have taught me a set of actions that if I take with consistency, I'm actually pretty likely to stay sober. But I don't think identification is enough. But what I do believe is that identification ruins future drinking. I think that an alcoholic of my type, once I've identified in AA, I'm not guaranteed physical sobriety, but I do believe that I'm pretty much guaranteed that I don't really get to have fun going out there and doing it again. So that motivates me to stick around. It motivates me to drive up to Santa Maria. It motivates me to take calls from sponsees. By the way, the funny thing is everything that I complain about in AA is also like the richness of my life. I still haven't quite sorted out how I can be so capable of having like two emotions at once, resentment that you're imposing on me and extraordinary gratitude for the abundance that imposition represents and gives me. But I'm very clever, I guess. And anyway, I identified, and then I did the next indicated action. It was Easter Sunday. I got on a train with some friends. I went up to Westchester County. I went to an Easter supper at one of their parents' house, and I had half a glass of white wine and half a glass of red wine. I had not committed to like staying sober 31 years and being your speaker. I committed to being sober for Lent, and Lent was over, and I drank. And it lit something in me, and I knew on a cellular level what I needed to do. I needed to go with my friends to the train station. I needed to get on the train. I needed to get back into Manhattan. I needed to lose my friends as quickly as possible. I needed to go back to my apartment, get out of my like Easter clothing into old ratty clothing, scrounge up whatever money I could find and get downtown and get drunk and stay drunk as long as I could. By the way, my guess is most of you could have like sung that chorus along with me. It wasn't complicated. I had drank and I knew what I needed to do next. But what I also remember is, in knowing that, I felt overwhelmingly tired. I just felt so exhausted. I had given up 40 days of physical sobriety, no program. I was manic, but I had been sober, and now I had alcohol in me again, and I felt it, and I felt so weary. And to give you a sense of how weary I felt, I'm a single parent. I don't know if I'll kind of talk about that tonight or not, but I've raised three children on my own from birth. My son's 17, my daughters are 15. I had three children under the age of two. So I know something about exhaustion. And I've got to tell you, the physical exhaustion I had was considerable for, I don't know, 5 or 10 years. But that mental exhaustion of being sober for a bit and then knowing I need to go downtown and get drunk and stay drunk and screw it. Whatever it takes, I've got to do. It's overwhelming. And the miracle is, I got back to my place, and I went to bed. What a gift. And I got up the next day, and I turned myself into Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not a vision for you. I was not happy. I think that the language of AA is the same language, but I think there are different dialects wherever we go. And I got to say, I was really lucky to get sober in New York where nobody expected me to be happy because I was not happy for quite a while. And I was like an angry, resentful, argumentative newcomer. I went to sharing meetings, and I was like the person who needed to share all the time. And, you know, I like would get my hand up, and if you didn't call on me, I would like stop your death. And everything was very important, and I was super anxious. I could handle being with one person, but for the first month, if I was around more than one person, I felt like I might throw up. And literally for the first month, I sat on the aisle at every meeting and plotted where the bathroom was because I really didn't know if I would make it through to the end of the meeting, but somehow or other I held onto my seat. My most immediate problem in early sobriety was my bike. I had gotten a bike 3 days before I got sober, and not like a cool vroom vroom Harley. It was like a delivery boy bike, like dun 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 dun, and I would pedal this bike everywhere. And my problem is that I kept on having bike accidents in early sobriety. I had 6 accidents in my first 5 weeks. I got hit by a door, I got hit by a cab, I flew over a pothole. At least one time, I sort of spontaneously went over my own handlebars, and I didn't wear a helmet. There's nothing in my story. Some of you, I have no doubt, have really badass stories, and I'm not just talking about the men. I'm not. But in my mind, I'm super tough. And so I don't wear a helmet because I think helmets are for wusses. So what I really like to do in early sobriety is bike around the island of Manhattan, arguing with imaginary people in my head while not wearing a helmet and getting hit by things. And that's my immediate problem. I'm 5 weeks sober. I'm going to your meetings and drinking your coffee and sharing a lot. I suddenly have this moment of clarity, which is that I don't care about anything. I don't. I don't know why I don't. I mean, I was raised by loving parents. I was given a lot of opportunities. I don't care. I just want the pain to end. The alcohol stops taking the pain away. AA hasn't worked yet. I just want out of the pain. And the truth is, I really just want the traffic of Manhattan to do for me what I am unable to do for myself. And here's the interesting thing. In the moment that I had the thought, that was completely true. But a moment later, I realized I wasn't as completely unsure as I thought I was. This is not a Disney movie. It wasn't like I immediately was filled with like love and joy and abundance and an image of my unborn children. And it was more like I went from 50-50 to 51-49. In the book, our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about the dilemma of the alcoholic who arrives in Alcoholics Anonymous is choosing between certain physical death and living life on spiritual terms. And I love that because you've got to take a moment to think about how freaking crazy that is. Like, we are people who, when presented with the option of allow a loving God into your life or die a painful alcoholic death, consider that a total dilemma. By the way, I can totally get it. That's exactly who I was. And maybe the Al-Anon speaker, if they want, will be generous enough to respond to this tomorrow. But I always just, in my mind, get humor thinking that Al-Anons, when they're reading our book for the first time, highlight that section. If you'd like to talk to their sponsor about it, probably like a really lovely, like an orange highlighter or green or something. Because it's like, I think in my mind, they just want to know, like, really? Like, this person who I love, who I've been so invested in their, like, recovery and their survival, cannot figure out the answer to the trick question, do you want a loving God in your life or death? Like, that's a hard one for them, and I can only imagine what the sponsor says. But I play these things in my head sometimes. That was my dilemma. I didn't know which would be less painful. And suddenly, after 5 weeks of drinking your coffee and going to your meetings, and most importantly, hearing you tell the truth, which astonished me, it was so weird. First of all, there's a quality in AA for us alcoholics when people are telling the truth. And even if I don't like what you're saying, there's just a quality when people are telling the truth. And I've been a bar drunk, lying and hearing lies, and I was just shocked at just the reckless fearlessness with which people would come to meetings and tell the truth. Like that just seemed wrong. Like, everything I'd grown up with my entire life told me that telling the truth did not lead to good outcomes, and there they were just doing it. And 5 weeks in, I just had this moment where something shifted, and I wasn't sure that I cared as little as I convinced myself. And that day, I pedaled down to 12th Street and I bought a helmet. And I immediately stopped having accidents. Our 11th step suggests that having come to believe in something bigger than myself, having turned my life over, having written an inventory and examined some of my fears and defects, made some work towards asking God to remove them, make some work towards, you know, making amends. It suggests that I continue to take personal inventory in step 10, and in step 11, it suggests that I expand my spiritual life through prayer and meditation. And I'm pleased to report at 31 years that I've done a fairly consistent job of doing that. I've not done it perfectly. And by the way, if you're interested in meeting the person who's perfect at meditation, I hope you find them. The fact that I do it at all amazes me. I can't believe I meditate on a regular basis. I don't do it great, but I do it. But here's what I can tell you about prayer. I have not been able to have any concept of God or a higher power, if you will, in my sobriety that is not capable of knowing what's on my mind, even if I don't tell what's on my mind. On a certain level, I don't get prayer because it just seems so obvious that any God that I can imagine already kind of knows what I'm thinking. So what I've worked to do in terms of prayer is to tie prayer to action. And I find that I get much quicker responses when I'm not just praying for some sense of hope, but like I'm taking an action like getting a helmet. I make my bed every morning. I think there are people whose spiritual stories are much more impressive than mine. I'm not saying it's exciting, but I'm somebody who makes my bed every morning because I want my life to be more organized and less cluttered. I want to show up more consistently for the people I care about, and it's like a metaphor for everything that I want to be in sobriety. I want to be somebody who makes my bed. You're not going to be in my bedroom, probably. You're not going to know that I did it, but I do it. I make my bed, and then I go on with my day. And that's what I think that helmet was. It was me not wanting to be suicidal, and it worked. I moved out to California when I was 3.5 years sober, and those people in New York, in spite of how unpleasant I was, had done an amazing job of sort of teaching me how AA works. Just the basics, get regular meetings and get them, have a little job, have a sponsor when you have some time, if you have something to offer and someone asks for help, sponsor them. They taught me really basic stuff and it worked. And then I moved out to California where everything seemed more like technicolor and vivid and the personalities were bigger. And I just did everything wrong. Many of us, over the time of our sobriety, will move. And if you ever find that you need to move and you want to learn how to avoid mistakes, feel free to give me a call, and I will tell you all the things that I did when I moved to California. And the long story short is that those people in New York had taught me how to be in the middle of our life, but there's a lot of lifeboat imagery in our literature that I love. And they taught me that not only do you want to be on the lifeboat, but you want to be in the middle of it. And over the next couple of years, I moved to the edge of the lifeboat. I didn't go overboard, dumb luck, but I moved to the edge of the lifeboat. And here's what I can tell you. If you've spent your entire sobriety in the middle of the lifeboat, what I can tell you about life on the edge of the lifeboat is sometimes the seas swell up. And when the waves break over the boat, people get swept over on the edge of the lifeboat. That's what happens. That's what life is like. It doesn't mean you're automatically going overboard, but you're a lot more likely to go overboard than the people around you are going overboard. And at first, I was so angry at you for disappointing me that I didn't care. And then I hit some moments of despair in sobriety where I just, 7 or 8 years, where I realized and remember that AA had been something very good in my life, and I liked being in the middle of the lifeboat. And this is the terrifying thing. And then I realized that, and I realized I would rather be back in the middle of the lifeboat. I couldn't find the middle of the lifeboat. I don't hear this phrase as much as I used to, but there used to be a lot of talk about the revolving door in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's referring to people who go in and out. And by the way, I'm not here to cast a judgment. I hope we don't have to go out, and I hope if we go out, we come back. It's not much more complicated than that for me. But there's no revolving door. There's literally a door. Almost literally every meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous has a door, and it is open. And what I've observed over the years from the inside is that the baffling thing is many people walk out that door, and many of them come back. But for some reason, and I don't know why, but it's just my observation, as open as that door visibly is to all of us, there are times when people try to come back, and that door to them is locked and barred, and they just can't make it back. And I'm really fortunate that I didn't go out. And when I was 8 years sober, I was at a meeting, and I did something shocking for me, which is I raised my hand and I told the truth, that I was lost and headed out. I think this is a terrible idea. I think being I'm fine for the part of AA where I tell you stories where I've kind of got it all figured out and well presented. I hate being vulnerable in front of people, and everything I was raised with teaches me that it's a bad idea. Nothing good is going to come from being vulnerable in front of people. Don't do it. And one of the things that I've had to experience in AA is sometimes when I get into enough pain, I make myself vulnerable, and I survive it. And I admitted what was happening, and something brilliant happened. There's a guy, Bob, who I knew, and Bob claims, because we've talked about it over the years, that he said it in a loving way. I think he was irritated with me. And he just said, Alan, I believe you. I think you are going out. You're 8 years sober. Have you not noticed that everyone with 8 years who goes out comes back? They don't all stay back, but they all come back at least once. Because if you're getting ready to be a newcomer, why don't you just start being a newcomer now? Why wait? And then he walked away. And he says it was loving. I don't think it was. But it hit. And I started remembering what I had done when I was a newcomer. And I still try to remember what I did when I was a newcomer, because it turns out AA doesn't change. I may have the ability to grow over time, but AA is fundamental truth and fundamental wisdom, and it's largely about me taking actions as a self-obsessed person to get out of self by being useful to God and God's kids. And if I do that regularly, it relieves me of sort of the crushing ego of active alcoholism. I didn't have a sponsor when I was new and it was working. I had a sponsor. I didn't have a home group. When I was new and working, I had a home group. I didn't have commitments. I just got a little too busy for that. And if that's never happened to you, good for you. But if it has, I get it. And I'm here to tell you the path back is just the path back. It's not reinventing the wheel. I went to the Pacific Group with almost 9 years of sobriety. I didn't quite have a sponsor at the beginning, and I didn't know where to go. And then I noticed that the person who seemed to sponsor a lot of people in the Pacific Group who had double-digit sobriety, who liked being sober, was 22. And I was 9 years sober and miserable. Miserable to myself, miserable to you. And I thought, you know, if I make it to double-digit sobriety and I like being sober, I'm doing a lot better. Maybe that's enough. And I went and I asked him to take on my case. He works down at the Midnight Mission, and I went down to the mission. I had coffee with him. I asked him to take on my case. I had a little bit of a goatee, plenty of reputation for not liking facial hair. I kept the goatee, but he could ask me to take it off, and I figured I would agree. And I realized I probably should have projected more of an internal struggle before I agreed, because I agreed very quickly to shave, and then he followed up with, you know, kid, it's good to be out in the sun enjoying life, I think you should come to the yard. And the yard was where we play softball and volleyball, and I'm terrible. Look, if you've never met a gay person before, there are many gay people who are good at sports. I'm just not that one. And I couldn't believe I had to go to the yard. But he said later I looked like a vampire, and it was July, and so I'm going to the yard, and I couldn't do it. And here's what was going on. This is 1999, and in 1999 that summer, there was a guy in my home group, Tom Wilson. He's passed away, so I think it's okay if I use his name. And Tom was living in a two-story apartment building, and we were bringing meetings. He lives on the second floor, and we were bringing a meeting on Tuesday nights to Tom's house. I was brand new, but someone who was taking me around meetings sort of swept me up and brought me to this meeting that we were bringing to Tom. Tom had advanced diabetes, and both of his legs had been amputated, and there was no elevator. We were bringing him meetings because he literally couldn't get out of his apartment. And Tom, for years, had coached the women's softball team in the Pacific Group. And the thing about a group as big as the Pacific Group, which is a large group, is no matter how obscure your problem is, there's somebody who knows how to work through it. And Tom Wilson was the person who talked people through their fear of playing softball. I know that's like an obscure thing, but that happened to be my problem. I was afraid of playing softball. I had a sponsor who was insisting that I show up to do it. and all these other old timers, Marianne Kay and Claire and Jim E and Glenn R. They're telling me, you gotta go talk to Tom. He will help you with this problem. And look, you've been listening to me for 40 or 50 minutes. It is obvious that I am capable of great feats of self-obsession. I know that. But even I could not quite see going to a man without legs and sniveling about my fear of playing softball. Like, that seems a little too much. But I was gonna get fired by Clancy if I didn't go to the yard. And I was out of ideas, and finally I went to Tom, and I said, they suggest that I talk to you. And two things happened. One is Tom gave me a very good piece of advice. He said, Alan, the yard is great for the jocks when they're new. It gives them something to do on a Saturday. He goes, but trust me, for the people who are afraid of it, it's transformative. If you go, it will change your life. But the more important thing was, something happened in Tom's eyes when he was talking. Tom is a man, an alcoholic, with real problems. And I had given him an opportunity to get out of self and be helpful to a new person who needed something he had. For a moment, he was lighter. And I had forgotten about that. I had recreated AA as a self-help program, and it disappointed me because it wasn't helping me enough. That's not what AA is. AA is a place where I can be, at times, helpful to somebody else and get out of self. And here's, as my friend Marianne says, many of my problems in recovery have died from benign neglect. My instinct when I have a problem is that I need to hunker down and analyze it and figure it out. And I can't explain this why, and by the way, I'm sure that there are many therapies that would disagree with this. I'm just reporting my own experience. The best thing I can often do when I have a problem is ignore the problem and focus on helping somebody. I cannot tell you how many things have minimized or healed entirely while I do that. That's just my experience, for whatever it's worth for anybody else. And that's what I started to do. I started to take commitments and go to meetings. I went to that yard. It was a year before I got a hit. And I would watch newcomers roll out of detox truck and hit triples. And I wished them pain. And I just kept showing up. And I was in right field. If you're not a softball player or a baseball player, right field is where you just put the worst person. And I'm, you know, 9 years over in right field. You know, getting hit by the ball in the face as often as I'm catching it and miserable. And people are like, you're doing a good job. And I'm like, you know, like, leave me alone. And finally, after a year, somebody took pity and took me to a batting cage. And I learned how to hit the ball. And I did. Joe Sandusky pitched me one time, and I got a home run. There were errors involved. I'm not supposed to tell you there were errors involved. Oh, I get a home run. There were errors involved, but like literally, that was as good as it got. And here's the important thing. I don't know why I'm wired this way. Maybe many of us are. I don't doubt for a moment that fear can kill. I believe that if I'm terrified enough, I will like burst into flames and there will just be a pile of ashes where once I stood. And it was really hard to walk through something week after week where I was really bad in front of everybody. And yet it liberated me. In walking through that experience, here's what I learned. I learned that when you're in a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous, your friends will tease you when you're really bad, and then you can just like brush it off and go on. And here's why it became important. About a year later, I had an idea to start a company. And like many of us, I've had an idea, you know, a good idea. And I'm great at letting fear paralyze me from pursuing an idea, because what if I fail? What if I embarrass myself? How will I face you if I'm a failure? But I've been a failure for a year at the yard, and nothing had happened except that I'd made some friends and stayed sober and gotten more comfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I started the business, and lo and behold, It didn't fail. And if you start a business and it doesn't fail for long enough, it's probably succeeded. And that was my experience, right? You know, I succeeded through not failing. And in 2002, I was sponsoring a lot of guys, and there's one really key difference between sponsoring gay guy newcomers and straight guy newcomers. Half the straight guys get girls pregnant, and that's just, I mean, I'm sure up in Santa Maria, nobody dates in their first year, and God bless you, but that was my experience, and it just sort of made me realize babies just sometimes happen, and that I started a family. I went down to Clancy when I was thinking about doing it. Clancy had a reputation for being a homophobe. I wanted his buy-in. I wasn't sure I would get it, and I wasn't sure what I would do if I didn't. But I said, you know, actually, I lied. I said, Clancy, I've got something to tell you. It was always good to disarm Clancy with humor. He goes, what? I go, I think you've gotten a girl in the family way. He goes, I'll be goddamned. And I said, no, not really, but I'm thinking about having a kid. And he just said, Alan, it's a commitment, and I've seen how you handle your commitments. He goes, you show up and you do them. If you're willing to treat it like a commitment and honor the responsibility and do it no matter what, I'm your sponsor and I'm here to support you. And you know, this is a long time ago. The world is a little bit different now. But, you know, 18 years ago, 17 years ago, it was different. And I would hear these stories about him at conferences in South Carolina, like boasting about his gay baby raising kids. And it's really sweet, and I felt supported, and that was important because it's a hard job. It is a hard job. I've had three teenagers during COVID. Like, we spent a year locked in the house, and one of my kids became anorectic during that time. And, you know, that's a lot. That's like a lot to deal with, even with a spiritual program and physical sobriety. But that's what I've learned. I've learned I did not do things alone here. I've learned to be supportive when I can and to accept support when I need it. I want to close by telling you a little story about Tom Wilson, the guy who helped me so much. And it's just, to me, it encapsulates something really special about AA. Tom got fitted with legs, and he didn't last a lot longer, but he did take one more cake. And at our meeting when it was in Brentwood at the synagogue, you would take your cake by walking up the staircase to the podium. And Tom took his final cake, what turned out to be his final cake, Clancy gave it to him, and on his own power, he walked up those steps. And he, in very simple but lovely words, expressed his gratitude for sobriety in his life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got it. I was literally seeing a man without legs get up and walk in Alcoholics Anonymous. A miracle, as I understand it, is God's intervention in the physical world. There's no such thing as a small miracle, because miracles prove the existence of something bigger than us. And I saw a miracle. I saw a man without legs get up and walk. And here's what I can tell you. My being sober doesn't make God real. My being sober doesn't make miracles occur. But my being sober is the only way that I have any hope of taking in how truly miraculous life is in recovery. That's the only way I get to get it. And that's what you've given me. You've given me the realization that all of that doom and gloom that I've carried for so long can be surrendered in recovery through steps, through actions, for something richer and more rewarding and more valuable, for a sense of connection and humanity, for a sense of an awareness of the presence of something greater than myself. And for that, I'm so grateful to you and to this opportunity that I didn't earn, but I'm so grateful to take advantage of. It's a really good life, and we've been through a rough year, and what I finally want to say is this. This has been a scary year and a half. It's polarized people, it's scared people, it's impacted people, and it's made people very angry. my copy of the Big Book still says, I can't afford anger even if it's justified. And that to me is the challenge of the moment in AA. I'm not telling you at all. In fact, believe what you believe. Practice what you practice. I'm outside, but in AA, we can't let anger in here because that is not what we're about. We're not about anger no matter how justified. We're about love and service. And this, showing up, reconnecting, walking through whatever the fear is how we get there, is how we keep this going. It's not a little thing to me to be here. It's important that we show up and we put aside outside things which are important in the outside world and we focus on sobriety and love and service and be here for each other as we are tonight. I'm so grateful to be here. Thank you very much.
That we did, I was another now.